rate of 4.1%. Whom do you trust to know your every move, to listen to your every heartbeat, to see when you're sleeping and know when you're awake, like a certain benevolent, mythical being of wintertime lore, to be able to identify through the data when you're feeling sad, driving too fast, having sex, or had too much to drink? There's no sense in trying to convince people that there's nothing to worry about. Of course there are things to worry about. Think having your credit card data stolen is bad? That's nothing. You can always call the bank and get a new credit card, but your medical records are permanent and far more personal. More than 110 million medical records were breached in the United States between 2010 and 2018. Jean-Frédéric Cacher, the head of security at Maintel, a UK communications provider, predicts that attacks will become far more common. Medical information can be worth 10 times more than credit card numbers on the deep web, he has warned. Fraudsters can use this data to create fake IDs to buy medical equipment or drugs. We already trade a tremendous amount of privacy for technological services. We do it all the time. We do it every time we start a bank account or sign up for a credit card. We do it often when we point our internet browsers to a new web page. We do it when we sign up for school. We do it when we get onto an airplane. And we do it a lot when we use our mobile phones. Have these been good trade-offs for everyone? That's a matter of personal opinion, of course. But when most people imagine not being able to use a credit card, surf the web, sign up for school, travel by air, or use their phones and smartwatches, they quickly conclude that the trade is tolerable. Will people trade a little more privacy to stop a global disease pandemic? Sadly, probably not. The tragedy of the commons is that humans are not very good at taking personal action to solve collective problems. The trick to revolutionary change is finding ways to make self-interest align with the common good. For people to accept widespread biometric tracking in a way that could help us get ahead of fast-moving deadly viruses, they'll need to be offered something they have a hard time seeing themselves without. How to get ready for this world is a conversation that needs to be had, and soon. I'm there already. Before I began having my biomarkers checked on a regular basis, I did worry about what the ever-changing chemical signals in my body could disclose about me to someone with access to my data. All the data are held on healthcare or HIPAA-compliant servers, and the data are encrypted. But there's always the fear that the data will be hacked. There's always a way. But after I began, the information I received was worth far more than the concerns I carry. It's a personal choice, no question. Now, having seen the changes on my dashboard, I cannot imagine living without it. Just as I now wonder how I ever managed to drive without a GPS, I wonder how I ever made decisions about what I should be eating and how much I should be exercising before I received regular updates from my biosensor ring and blood biomarker reports. Indeed, I'm eager for the day in which the data about my health are processed in real time, and if that can help protect others, all the better. Moving faster. While I was doing my PhD, I had a night job. For about $8 an hour, I tested body fluids: urine, feces, spinal fluid, blood, and genital swabs horribly twisted in hair, for the presence of deadly bacteria, parasites, and fungi. It was glamorous work. At my disposal, I had all the trappings of 19th century technology: microscopes, petri dishes, sterile water. A lab technician transported from 1895 to that 1980s microbiology lab would have felt right at home. Today, this is still how many microbiology labs operate. Making life and death calls this way was frustrating. In every other branch of medicine, we've made enormous strides technologically, with robotics, nanotechnology, scanners, and spectrometers. These days, though, I'm no longer frustrated, I'm furious. Antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria continue to spread, and new studies implicate bacteria as causal agents in cancer, heart disease, and Alzheimer's disease. But I wasn't working to solve this problem until recently. A brush with Lyme disease has a way of intensifying a person's feelings about these sorts of things. Our daughter Natalie was 11 years old when it happened. In New England, where we live, there is an epidemic of ticks that carry the bacterial spirochete Borrelia burgdorferi, which causes Lyme disease. Recent estimates suggest that approximately 300,000 people in the United States may contract the disease each year. Left untreated, Borrelia hides out in skin cells and lymph nodes, causing facial paralysis, heart problems, nerve pain, memory loss, and arthritis. It hides in a protective biofilm, making it extremely difficult to kill. Natalie never had a red ring of skin around a tick bite, a sure sign you've contracted the parasite. She had been complaining about a headache and sore back, typical signs of flu. But it quickly became clear that this wasn't flu. It was something much worse. She was unable to turn her head. She was losing her eyesight. She was terrified. My wife and I were too. We'd never felt so helpless in our lives. We began searching online for answers. Potential diseases included leukemia and a viral infection of the brain. Doctors at Boston Children's Hospital began poring over her. The first test lit up Lyme disease proteins, but the insurance company needed confirmation because the first test occasionally gives a false positive. The second test failed, putting the course of treatment into limbo pending more lab results. I asked for a microliter sample of Natalie's spinal fluid to test. My lab was across the street, and I could sequence the DNA of the pathogen. The hospital refused. Given the state of her symptoms at that point, I've since learned, she had a 50% chance of survival. Her life came down to a coin flip. At a time when every second counted, doctors were waiting on lab results. It took 3 days to confirm that it was a Lyme disease infection, and finally the doctors gave Natalie intravenous antibiotics directly into the large vein next to her heart. She received that treatment every day for nearly a month. She is okay now, but it was clear to everyone involved, especially Natalie, that we desperately need to be applying 21st century technologies to diagnosing infectious diseases. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Menlo Park, California, I've helped gather a group of very smart folks, infectious disease doctors, microbiologists, geneticists, mathematicians, and software engineers, to develop tests that can rapidly and unambiguously tell physicians what an infection is and how best to kill it using high-throughput sequencing. The first step in this process is the extraction of nucleic acids from blood samples, saliva, feces, or spinal fluid. Because it adds cost and reduces sensitivity, the patient's DNA is removed using innovative methods honed by the same scientists who extract ancient DNA from mummies. One of the countless cases of one field of science benefiting another. Next, the samples are processed through agnostic DNA sequencing technologies, meaning that the system is not looking for any one specific infectious agent, but rather reading the genomes in the entire sample. That list is then scanned against a database of all known human pathogens at the strain level. The computer spits out a highly detailed report about what invaders are present and how best to kill them. The tests are as accurate as the standard ones, but they provide strain-level information and are pathogen-agnostic. In other words, soon doctors won't have to guess what to look for when ordering a test or what treatment will work best. They will know. Just a few years ago, this wouldn't just have been a slow process. It wouldn't even have been possible. Now it can be done in days. Soon it will be able to be done in hours and eventually minutes. But there's another way to deal with such diseases. We could prevent them altogether. The new age of inoculation. There is no rational debate over the immensely positive impact of vaccines on life expectancy and healthy lifespans over the past century. Childhood mortality around the world has plummeted, in no small part because we've wiped out diseases such as smallpox. The number of healthy children in the world has risen because we've destroyed polio. The number of healthy adults has too. within 50 years, post-polio syndrome, which causes fatigue, muscle weakness, abnormal spinal curvature, and speech defects in adults, will be extinct. And, of course, the more diseases we can vaccinate for, especially those that claim elderly people's lives, such as the flu and pneumonia, the more life expectancy will rise in the coming years. When we inoculate the herd, it doesn't just protect us individually, it protects the weakest among us, the young and the old. Chickenpox once claimed thousands of lives each year around the world, mostly among the very young and the very old, and accounted for hundreds of thousands of hospitalizations and millions of days of missed work. Those days are over. A shining example of the power of vaccines to extend lifespan came in the years after the introduction of vaccines for Streptococcus pneumoniae, a major source of illness in older persons and the most common cause of death by respiratory infection. After the Prevnar vaccine for infants was launched in 2000, hospitalization and deaths from pneumonia fell across the board, according to a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine. The protective effect we saw in older adults who do not receive the vaccine but benefit from vaccination of infants is quite remarkable, the study's first author, Marie Griffin, explained. It is one of the most dramatic examples of indirect protection or herd immunity we have seen in recent years. In the first 3 years alone, deaths from pneumonia were halved, averting more than 30,000 cases and 3,000 deaths in the United States alone, according to another study. We can snuff out a lot of killers with vaccines like this. Yet for several decades, the promise of vaccines to improve the lives of billions of people around the world has been slowed, not only by a distrust of vaccines promulgated by debunked science, but by plain old market forces. The golden era of vaccine research was in the mid-20th century, a time that saw the quick development of a succession of exceptionally effective inoculations against whooping cough, polio, mumps, measles, rubella, and meningitis. But by the latter part of the century, the business model that long sustained vaccine research and development was badly broken. The cost of testing new vaccines had risen exponentially, thanks in large part to increasing public concerns about safety and risk-averse regulatory bodies. The low-hanging fruit of the inoculation world had already been picked. Now, a simple vaccine can take more than a decade to produce and cost more than $500 million, and there is still the chance it won't be approved for sale. Even some vaccines that have worked well and been critical for the prevention of epidemics, such as GlaxoSmithKline's Lyme disease vaccine, have been taken off the market because the unfounded backlash against vaccines made continuation of the product just not worth it. Governments don't make vaccines, companies do. So when the market forces are not conducive, we don't get the medicines we so badly need. Funding gaps are sometimes made up by charitable organizations, but not nearly enough. And economic downturns, such as the global recession of the late 2000s and early 2010s, left foundations, many of which base their giving on market-tied endowment earnings, unable or unwilling to invest as much in these life-saving interventions. The good news is that we are experiencing a mini renaissance in vaccine research and development, which has tripled between 2005 and 2015, now accounting for about a quarter of all biotechnology products being developed. The big one is malaria, infecting 219 million people and claiming 435,000 people in 2017. Thanks to Bill and Melinda Gates, GlaxoSmithKline, and Program for Appropriate Technology in Health, or PATH, a partially effective vaccine against malaria, known as Mosquirix, was deployed for the first time in 2017, giving hope that the malaria parasite will one day be pushed into extinction. We are also learning how to quickly grow vaccines in human cells, mosquito cells, and bacteria, avoiding the time and expense of infecting the millions of fertilized chicken eggs we currently use, a remarkably antiquated process. One Boston-based research consortium was able to get a vaccine for Lassa fever, a disease similar to Ebola, all the way to the animal testing stage in just 4 months and for about $1 million, cutting many years and many millions of dollars from the usual process. That's nothing short of astounding. At this moment, researchers are starting the final sprint toward the end of a very long race to develop vaccines that will inoculate us against diseases that are so ubiquitous that we simply accept them as part of life. Many thought leaders predict, though with some trepidation, that it won't be long before we're no longer throwing Hail Mary passes, such as the annual influenza vaccine, which in some years protects less than a third of its recipients, which is still far better than nothing. If you don't get flu vaccines or vaccinate your kids, please do. We are privileged to live in an age in which we can protect ourselves and our children from potentially deadly diseases. The ability to quickly detect, diagnose, treat, and even prevent diseases that aren't related to aging, but that claim many millions of lives each year, will allow us to continue to push our average life expectancy higher and higher, closing the gap between the mean and the maximum. Even then, organs will fail and body parts will wear out. What will we do when all other technologies fail? There's a revolution happening there too. The organ grind. The Great Ocean Road, which runs along the Australian coast west of Melbourne, is among the most beautiful stretches of highway in the world. But whenever I'm on it, I can't help but remember one of the most frightening days of my life, the day I got a call telling me that my brother Nick had been in a motorcycle accident. He was 23 years old at the time and touring the country by motorbike. He was an expert rider, but he hit an oil patch, flew from his bike, and slid under a metal barrier that crushed his ribs and ruptured his spleen. Fortunately, he pulled through, but to save his life, the emergency room doctors had to remove his spleen, which is involved in the production of blood cells and is an important part of the immune system. For the rest of his life, he has to be careful not to get a major infection, and he certainly seems to get sicker more often and take longer to get better. People without a spleen are also at higher risk of dying of pneumonia later in life. It doesn't take age or disease to do a number on our organs. Sometimes life does that to us in other ways, and if we're lucky, it's just our spleen that we lose. Hearts, livers, kidneys, and lungs are a lot harder to live without. The same kind of cellular reprogramming we can use to restore optic nerves and eyesight may one day offer us the ability to restore function in damaged organs. But what can we do for organs that have completely failed or need to be removed because of a tumor? Right now, there's only one way to effectively replace damaged and diseased organs. It's a morbid truth, but it's a truth nonetheless. When people pray for an organ to become available for a loved one who needs one, part of what they're praying for is a deadly car accident. There's a lot of irony, or some would say logic, in the fact that the Department of Motor Vehicles is the organization that asks people whether they want to be organ donors. Each year in the United States alone, more than 35,000 people are killed in motor vehicle accidents, making this mode of death one of the most reliable sources of tissues and organs. If you haven't signed up to be an organ donor, I hope you consider it. Between 1988 and 2006, the number of people waiting for a new organ grew sixfold. As I write this sentence, there are 114,271 people on the US online registry waiting for organ transplants, and every 10 minutes, someone new is added to the transplant waitlist. It's even worse for patients in Japan, where the ability to get an organ transplant remains far below those of Western countries. The reasons are both cultural and legal. In 1968, the Buddhist belief that the body should not be divided after death fueled an emotion-laden firestorm in the media about whether the first Japanese heart donor had truly been brain dead when the heart was removed by Dr. Juro Wada. A strict law was immediately enacted that banned the removal of organs from a cadaver until the heart had stopped beating. The law was relaxed 30 years later, but the Japanese remained divided on the issue, and good organs remain hard to come by. My brother also suffers from an eye disease called keratoconus, which caused the corneas covering his lenses to wrinkle like a finger pushed into plastic wrap. To treat this, he had two separate corneal transplant surgeries, one in his 20s, the other in his 30s, that swapped two other people's corneas for his. Both times, he suffered through 6 months of corneal stitches that felt like branches in his eyes, but his vision was saved. The fact that Nick now literally sees the world through others' eyes is an amusing topic for dinner conversation that belies the true depth of our family's gratefulness to his deceased donors. Now, as we rapidly approach the era of self-driving cars, a technological and social paradigm shift that almost every expert expects will rapidly reduce car crashes, we need to confront an important question. Where will the organs come from? The geneticist Luhan Yang and her former mentor, Professor George Church in my department at Harvard Medical School, had just discovered how to gene edit mammalian cells when they began working to edit out genes in pigs. To what end? They envisioned a world in which pig farmers raise animals specifically designed to produce organs for the millions of people who are on transplant waiting lists. Though scientists have had dreams of widespread xenotransplantation for many decades, Yan took one of the biggest steps toward that goal when she and her colleagues demonstrated that they could use gene editing to eliminate dozens of retroviral genes from pigs that currently prevent them from donating organs. That's not the only obstacle to xenotransplantation, but it's a big one, and one that Yang figured out how to overcome before her 32nd birthday. That's not the only way we'll be getting organs in the future. Ever since researchers discovered in the early 2000s that they could modify inkjet printers to lay down 3D layers of living cells, scientists around the world have been working toward the goal of printing living tissue. Today, scientists have implanted printed ovaries into mice and spliced printed arteries into monkeys. Others are working on printing skeletal tissue to fix broken bones, and printed skin is likely to start being used for grafts in the next few years, with livers and kidneys coming soon after that, and hearts, which are a bit more complicated, a few years behind. Soon it won't matter if the morbid pipeline for human organ transplantation ends. That pipeline never met the demand anyway. In the future, when we need body parts, we might very well print them, perhaps by using our own stem cells, which will be harvested and stored for just such an occasion, or even using reprogrammed cells taken from blood or a mouth swab. And because there won't be competition for these organs, we won't have to wait for things to go catastrophically wrong for someone else to get one. We'll only have to wait for the printer to do its job. Just imagine. Is all this hard to imagine? That's understandable. We've spent a long time building up our expectations of what medical care should look like, and indeed, what human life should look like. For a lot of people, it's simply easier to say, "I just don't believe that will happen," and leave things at that. But we're actually quite a bit better at changing our minds about what we expect out of life and what age actually means than many of us think we are. Consider Tom Cruise. As the Top Gun actor entered his late 50s, with bulging muscles and a straight line of dark hair sprouting from a minimally wrinkled forehead, he was still at work. Not just acting, but doing the sort of acting that has long been the purview of much younger actors. He was still doing many of his own dangerous stunts too, riding motorcycles at high speed through alleys, being strapped to the outside of a plane as it takes off, hanging off the top of the world's tallest building, skydiving from the upper reaches of the atmosphere. How easily do the words 50 is the new 30 slide from our lips these days? We forget what we used to expect life past 50 to look like. Not hundreds of years in the past, but just a few decades ago. It didn't look like Tom Cruise jumping out of airplanes. It looked like Wilford Brimley. In the 1980s, Brimley was one of Cruise's co-stars in the movie The Firm. Cruise was 39 and Brimley 58. Already a grey-haired old man with a walrus mustache. A few years earlier, Brimley had starred in Cocoon, a movie about a group of senior citizens who stumble upon an alien fountain of youth that gives them the energy, although not the looks, of their youth. the image of old folks running around like teenagers was played to great comedic effect. It was audacious to think of someone that age acting so youthful. At the time the movie was released, though, Brimley was 5 or 6 years younger than Cruise is now. According to Ian Crouch of The New Yorker, Cruise has easily blasted through what he calls the Brimley Barrier. Barriers fall, and they will fall again. In another generation, we'll be well accustomed to seeing movie stars in their 60s and 70s riding motorcycles at high speeds, jumping from great heights, and delivering kung fu kicks high into the air. Because 60 will be the new 40, then 70 the new 40, and so on it will go. When will this happen? It's already happening. It is not fanciful to say that if you are hearing these words, you are likely to benefit from this revolution. You will look younger, act younger, and be younger, both physically and mentally. You will live longer, and those extra years will be better. Yes, it is true that any one technology might lead to a dead end, but there is simply no way that all of them will fail. Taken separately, any one of these innovations in pharmaceuticals, precision medicine, emergency care, and public health would save lives, providing extra years that would otherwise have been lost. When we take them together, though, we are staring up the road at decades of longer, healthier life. Each new discovery creates new potential. Each minute saved in the quest for faster and more accurate gene sequencing can help save lives. Even if it doesn't move the needle much on the maximum number of years we live, this age of innovation will ensure that we stay much healthier, much longer. Not many of us much of the time, but all of us. So Matt, there are a lot of things to unpack in that chapter. Where do you want to start?
Well, I guess what I'd like to do is go back to a conversation you and I had when we were first mapping out the book. Up until that point, I think I was slowly coming around to the optimism you have about our future. And I'd actually come to expect that from you, which was sort of refreshing because a lot of scientists aren't so optimistic about our future. But then I remember saying something like, yeah, but David, all of these extra years could be wiped out in a pandemic. And what I thought you were going to say was something like super optimistic. And instead you said, yeah, that's the greatest threat to our existence. That was scary to me, but also, like, I don't know, like leveling as well. That this is really the thing that most threatens us if we don't figure out how to handle it, right?
Oh, for sure. I think a meteorite wiping us out could happen, but that's a really low risk. What we know for sure is going to happen. It's not an if, it's a when, is that a virus such as influenza will mutate that kills half of everybody that gets it or more, and you can catch it just by touching a doorknob. When that happens, our species could lose, you know, 1 billion people within the first year. And that's the kind of world that, you know, could just bring down the stock market and we go back to the Middle Ages. That could happen. That could happen within our lifetimes. And that's a really scary thought.
What do we do about that?
Well, we do need an industry that can very rapidly respond to new infections like Ebola. And that has happened somewhat, but it's not fast enough. Ebola vaccine has taken a few years. I hear there's one that's working well now, but we can't wait a few years. We'll lose half the planet in the meantime. So we need an industry ready to go with governments on the ready with an action plan. And as we saw with Ebola, they were definitely not ready around the world. It was very difficult to have a unified plan of attack. And the third thing that we don't do well is track the diseases, the spread. Even today, we don't track viruses very well, let alone the common cold. We just go to the doctor and the doctor says cough, and we send off a sputum or a blood test to see what grows. In the same way we did 100 years ago, we haven't really done much more in the microbial labs that we had at our disposal when the Petri dishes were first invented.
So that's all pretty scary to me, but there's also a lot to be positive about in this chapter. Precision medicine, the idea of using genes and biomarkers and the human microbiome to identify diseases before people are even close to being symptomatic, that's pretty exciting stuff.
Well, we have the geneticists to thank for that. We can now, instead of spending $1 billion to sequence one human genome, in my lab we can use a little Milky Way bar-sized object to sequence a whole human genome in a couple of days. And in the future, it'll be done at home if you want to. With that technology, and as I'm working with a group over near MIT, technology partially out of my lab, partially out of Carlos Bustamante's lab at Stanford, we're using that sequencing technology to find what organisms are in our bodies, the ones that are good, but also the ones that are bad, and then using artificial intelligence, figure out how to kill those. So one day, every kid with a runny nose will go to the doctor. They'll put it in a machine that's tiny, and within 10 minutes, the doctor will say, okay, it's streptococcus whatever, and here's the antibiotic that we know will kill it, rather than waiting 2-3 days, sometimes a week, guessing at what's causing the problem, and then trying antibiotics and hoping that one of them will work.
And you mentioned little kids with runny noses, but of course the same thing is going to work for older people too. And the net effect of this is, again, longer and healthier lives, right?
Oh, for sure. I mean, that's why I wanted this to be in the book. There's no use living a long, healthy life if you can be killed in a day from a virus. So we need to attack both of those areas of health. You know, we did a very good job of making vaccines over the last couple of hundred years, but we're slowly losing the fight. Antibiotics are becoming less useful. Bugs are becoming resistant. Fewer and fewer people are interested and excited about vaccines. We're becoming complacent. And we could end up in a world that could have prevented a catastrophe, but didn't. Part 3. Where we're going. The future. 8. The shape of things to come. Let's do a little math, and let's make it conservative math. Let's assume that each of these vastly different technologies emerging over the next 50 years independently contributes to a longer, healthier lifespan. DNA monitoring will soon be alerting doctors to diseases long before they become acute. We will identify and begin to fight cancer years earlier. If you have an infection, it will be diagnosed within minutes. If your heartbeat is irregular, your car seat will let you know. A breath analyzer will detect an immune disease beginning to develop. Keystrokes on the keyboard will signal early Parkinson's disease or multiple sclerosis. Doctors will have far more information about their patients, and they will have access to it long before patients arrive at a clinic or hospital. Medical errors and misdiagnoses will be slashed. The result of any one of these innovations could be decades of prolonged healthy life. Let's say, though, that all these developments together will give us a decade. Once people begin to accept that aging is not an inevitable part of life, will they take better care of themselves? I certainly have. So too, it seems, have most of my friends and family members. Even as we have all stepped forward to be early adopters of biomedical and technological interventions that reduce the noise in our epigenomes and keep watch over the biochemical systems that keep us alive and healthy, I've noticed a definite tendency to eat fewer calories, reduce animal-based aminos, engage in more exercise, and stoke the development of brown fat by embracing a life outside the thermoneutral zone. These are remedies available to most people, regardless of socioeconomic status, and the impact on vitality has been exceptionally well studied. 10 additional healthy years is not an unreasonable expectation for people who eat well and stay active. But let's cut that by half. Let's call it 5. That's 15 years. Molecules that bolster our survival circuit, putting our longevity genes to work, have offered between 10 and 40% more healthy years in animal studies. But let's go with 10%, which gives us another 8 years. That's 23 years total. How long will it be before we are able to reset our epigenome, either with molecules we ingest or by genetically modifying our bodies, as my student now does in mice? How long until we can destroy senescent cells, either by drugs or outright vaccination? How long until we can replace parts of organs, grow entire ones in genetically altered farm animals, or create them in a 3D printer? A couple of decades, perhaps, maybe 3. One or all of those innovations is coming well within the ever-increasing lifespans of most of us, though. And when that happens, how many more years will we get? The maximum potential could be centuries, but let's say it's only 10. That's 33 years. At the moment, life expectancy in the developed world is a tad over 80 years. Add 33 to that. That's 113 years, a conservative estimate of life expectancy in the future, as long as most people come along for the ride. And recall that this number means that over half the population will exceed that number. It's true that not all of these advances will be additive. Not everyone will eat well and exercise. But also consider that the longer we live, the greater chance we have of benefiting from radical medical advances that we cannot foresee. And the advances we've already made are not going away. That's why, as we move faster and faster toward a Star Trek world, for every month you manage to stay alive, you gain another week of life. 40 years from now, it could be another 2 weeks. 80 years from now, another 3. Things could get really interesting around the end of the century if, for every month you are alive, you live another 4 weeks. This is why I say that Jean Calment, who may have had the longest lifespan of any person on our planet, will eventually fall off the list of the top 10 oldest humans in history. And it won't be more than a few decades after that that she will leave the top 100. After that, she will leave the top million. Imagine if people who had lived beyond 110 had had access to all these technologies. Could they have made it to 120 or 130? Perhaps. Fellow scientists often warn me not to be so publicly optimistic. It's not a good look, one well-meaning colleague recently told me. Why? I asked. Because the public isn't ready for these numbers. I disagree. 10 years ago, I was a pariah to many of my colleagues for even talking about making medicines to help patients. One scientist told me that our job as researchers is to just show a molecule extends lifespan in mice, and the public will take it from there. Sadly, I wish that were true. Today, many of my colleagues are just as optimistic as I am, even though they don't admit it publicly. I'd wager that about a third of them take metformin or an NAD booster. A few of them even take low doses of rapamycin intermittently. International conferences, specifically about longevity interventions, are now held every few weeks. The participants are not charlatans, but renowned scientists from the world's most prestigious universities and research centers. In these gatherings, it is no longer unusual to hear chatter about how raising the average human lifespan by a decade, if not more, will change our world. Mind you, the debate is not about whether this will happen. It is about what we should do when it happens. The same is increasingly true among the political, business, and religious leaders with whom I spend more and more of my time these days, talking not just about new technologies, but about their implications. Slowly but surely, these individuals, legislators, heads of state, CEOs, and thought leaders, are coming to recognize the world-changing potential of the work being done in the field of aging, and they want to be ready. All these people might be wrong. I might be wrong, but I expect to be around long enough to know one way or the other. If I am wrong, it might be that I was too conservative in my predictions. Though there are many examples of false predictions, who can forget nuclear-powered vacuum cleaners and flying cars? It is far more common for people not to see something coming. All of us are guilty of it. We extrapolate linearly. More people, more horses, more horse manure. More cars, more air pollution, always more climate change. But that's not how it works. When technologies go exponential, even experts can be blindsided. The American physicist Albert Michelson, who won a Nobel Prize for measuring the speed of light, gave a speech at the University of Chicago in 1894, declaring that there was probably little else to discover in physics besides additional decimal places. He died in 1931 as quantum mechanics was in full swing. And in his 1995 book, The Road Ahead, Bill Gates made no mention of the internet, though he substantially revised it about a year later, humbly admitting that he had vastly underestimated how important and how quickly the internet would come to prominence. Kevin Kelly, the founding editor of Wired magazine, who has a better track record than most at predicting the future, has a golden rule. Embrace things rather than try and fight them. Work with things rather than try and run from them or prohibit them. We often fail to acknowledge that knowledge is multiplicative and technologies are synergistic. Humankind is far more innovative than we give it credit for. Over the past two centuries, generation after generation has witnessed the sudden appearance of new and strange technologies. Steam engines, metal ships, horseless carriages, skyscrapers, planes, personal computers, the internet, flat-screen TVs, mobile devices, and gene-edited babies. At first we are shocked, then we barely notice. When the human brain was evolving, the only things to change in a lifetime were the seasons. It should come as no surprise that we find it hard to predict what will happen when millions of people work on complex technologies that suddenly merge. No matter if I'm right or wrong about the pace of change, barring a war or an epidemic, our lifespan will continue to rise. And the more thought leaders I speak to around the globe, the more I realize how vast the implications are. And yes, some of those people have allowed me to think and plan for events well beyond the initial scope of my research. But the people who push me to think even harder are the younger people I teach at Harvard and other universities, and the often even younger people I hear from via email and social media nearly every day. They push me to think about how my work will impact the future workforce, global healthcare, and the very fabric of our moral universe, and to better understand the changes that must take place if we are to meet a world of significantly prolonged human health spans and lifespans with equity, equality, and human decency. If the medical revolution happens and we continue on the linear path we're already on, some estimates suggest half of all children born in Japan today will live past 107. In the United States, the age is 104. Many researchers believe that those estimates are overly generous, but I don't. They might be conservative. I have long said that even if a few of the therapies and treatments that are most promising come to fruition, it is not an unreasonable expectation for anyone who is alive and healthy today to reach 100 in good health, active and engaged at levels we'd expect of healthy 50-year-olds today. 120 is our known potential, but there is no reason to think that it needs to be for the outliers. And I am on record saying, in part to make a statement, and in part because I have a front row seat on what's around the corner, that we could be living with the world's first sesquicentenarian. If cellular reprogramming reaches its potential, by century's end, 150 may not be out of reach. At the moment I write this, there is no one on our planet, no one whose age can be verified at least, who is over the age of 120. So it will be several decades at least before we know if I'm right about this, and it could take 150 years before someone steps over that threshold. But as for the next century, and the next, it is not at all extravagant to expect that someday living to 150 will be standard. And if the information theory of aging is sound, there may be no upward limit. We could potentially reset the epigenome in perpetuity. This is terrifying to a lot of people, and understandably so. We're on the cusp of upending nearly every idea we've ever had about what it means to be human. And that has a lot of people saying, not just that it can't be done, but that it shouldn't be done, for it will surely lead to our doom. The critics of my life's work aren't nameless, faceless social media trolls. Sometimes they are my colleagues. Sometimes they are my close personal friends. And sometimes they are my own flesh and blood. Our oldest child, Alex, who at 16 hopes for a career in politics and social justice, has often struggled to see the future with the same optimism I do. Especially when we're young, it is hard to see much of an arc to the moral universe, let alone one that bends towards justice. Alex grew up, after all, in a world that is quickly and disastrously warming. in a nation that has been at war for the better part of two decades, and in a city that suffered a terrorist attack on the people participating in one of its most cherished traditions, the Boston Marathon. And like so many other young people, Alex lives in a hyper-connected universe where news of one humanitarian crisis after the next, from Syria to South Sudan, is never far from the screen of a smartphone. So I understand, or I try to at least, but it was disappointing to learn one recent night that Alex didn't share the optimism I've always had about the future. Of course, I'm proud that our kid has such a strong moral compass, but it was saddening to realize this more pessimistic view of the world cast a significant shadow over the way Alex sees my life's work. Your generation, just like all the ones that came before, didn't do anything about the destruction that is being done to this planet, Alex told me that evening. And now you want to help people live longer so that they can do even more damage to the world? I went to bed that night troubled. Not by our firstborn's denouncement of me, of that I admit I was a little proud. We'll never destroy the global patriarchy if our children don't first practice on their fathers. No, what I was troubled by, what kept me up that night and has done so many since, were the questions that I simply could not answer. Most people, upon coming to the realization that longer human lives are imminent, also quickly recognize that such a transition cannot possibly occur without significant social, political, and economic change. And they are right. There can be no evolution without disruption. So what if the way I see the future isn't at all what we're headed toward? What if giving billions of people longer and healthier lives enables our species to do greater harm to this planet and to one another? Greater longevity is inevitable, I'm sure of it. What if it inevitably leads to our self-destruction? What if what I do makes the world worse? There are plenty of people out there, some of them very smart and very informed, who think that's the case. But I'm still optimistic about our shared future. I don't agree with the naysayers. But that doesn't mean I do not listen to them. I do, and we all should. That's why, in this chapter, I'm going to explain some of their concerns. Indeed, concerns I share in many cases. But I'll also present a different way of thinking about our future. You can take it from there. The 100 Years Warning. The number of Homo sapiens grew slowly over the first few hundred thousand years of our history, and, at least on one occasion, we almost went extinct. While there are many young skeletons from the late Archaic and Paleolithic periods, there is only a handful of skeletons of individuals over the age of 40. It was rare for individuals to make it to the point we now have the luxury of calling middle age. Recall, this was a time when teenage girls were mothers and teenage boys were warriors. Generations turned over quickly. Only the fastest, smartest, strongest, and most resilient tended to survive. We rapidly evolved superior bipedal and analytical skills, but at the expense of millions of brutal lives and early deaths. Our ancestors bred as fast as biology allowed, which was only slightly faster than the death rate. But that was enough. Humanity endured and scattered to all ends of the planet. It wasn't until right around the time Christopher Columbus rediscovered the New World that we reached the 500 million individuals mark. But it took just 300 more years for that population to double. And today, with each new human life, our planet becomes more crowded, hurtling us toward, or perhaps further beyond, what it can sustain. How many is too many? One report, which examined 65 different scientific projections, concluded that the most common estimated carrying capacity of our planet is 8 billion. That's just about where we're at right now. And barring a nuclear holocaust or a global pandemic of historically deadly proportions, nothing anyone in his or her right mind would ever wish for, that's not where our population is going to peak. When the Pew Research Center polled members of the largest association of scientists in the world, 82% said that there isn't enough food and other resources on this planet for its fast-growing human population. Among those who held that opinion was Frank Fenner, an eminent Australian scientist who helped bring an end to one of the world's deadliest diseases as the chairman of the Global Commission for the Certification of Smallpox Eradication. It was Fenner, in fact, who had the distinct honour of announcing the eradication of the disease to the World Health Organization's governing body in 1980. Having helped millions of people avoid a virus that killed nearly a third of those who contracted the disease, Fenner would have been justified in indulging in a little exuberant optimism about the ways in which people can come together to save themselves. He had planned a quiet retirement, but his mind wouldn't stop working. He couldn't stop trying to identify and solve big problems. He spent the next 20 years of his life writing about other threats to humankind, many of which had been virtually ignored by the same World Health leaders who had banded together to stop smallpox. His final act of forewarning came just a few months before his death in 2010, when he told the Australian newspaper that the human population explosion and unbridled consumption had already sealed our species' fate. Humanity would be gone in the next 100 years, he said. There are too many people here already. We've heard this song before, of course. At the turn of the 19th century, as the global human population was screaming past the 1 billion mark, the English scholar Thomas Malthus warned that advances in food production inevitably led to population growth, placing increasing numbers of poor people at greater risk of starvation and disease. Viewed from the developed world, it often looks as though a Malthusian catastrophe has largely been avoided. Agricultural advances have kept us one step ahead of disaster. Viewed globally, though, Malthus's warnings were a little short of prophetic. About the same number of people who lived on the planet in Malthus's time go hungry in our time. In 1968, as the global population approached 3.5 billion, Stanford University professor Paul Ehrlich and his wife, associate director of Stanford's Center for Conservation Biology, Anne Ehrlich, sounded the Malthusian alarm once again in a best-selling book called The Population Bomb. When I was young, that book had a rather prominent place on my father's bookshelf, right at eye level for a young boy. The cover was disturbing. A plump, smiling baby sitting inside a bomb with a lit fuse. I had nightmares about that. What was inside the cover was worse, though. In the book, Ehrlich described his awakening to the horrors to come, a revelation he had during a cab ride in New Delhi. "The streets seemed alive with people," he wrote. "People eating, people washing, people sleeping, people visiting, arguing and screaming, people thrusting their hands through the taxi window, begging, people defecating and urinating, people clinging to buses, people herding animals, people, 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 people." With every new year, the Ehrlichs wrote, global food production falls a bit further behind burgeoning population growth, and people go to bed a little hungrier. While there are temporary or local reversals of this trend, it now seems inevitable that it will continue to its logical conclusion, mass starvation. It's horrifyingly clear, of course, that millions of people have indeed died of starvation in the decades that have passed since the population bomb was first published, but not nearly at the levels the Ehrlichs predicted, and not typically because of a lack of food production, but rather as a result of political crises and military conflicts. When a child starves, though, it doesn't much matter to them or their family how it came to happen. Though the direst of their predictions did not come to pass, in focusing so intently on the food production-population relationship, Malthus and the Ehrlichs may actually have underestimated the greater and long-term risk. Not mass starvation that might claim hundreds of millions of lives, but a planetary rebellion that will kill us all. In November 2016, the late physicist Stephen Hawking predicted that humanity had less than 1,000 years left on our fragile planet. A few months of contemplation later, he revised his estimate downward by 90%. Echoing Fenner's warnings, Hawking believed that humanity would have 100 years to find a new place to live. "We are running out of space on Earth," he said. a lot of good that will do. The Earth-like planet that is nearest to our solar system is 4.2 light years away. Barring major advances in warp speed or wormhole transit technology, it would take us 10,000 years to get there. The problem is not just population, it's consumption. And it's not just consumption, it's waste. In comes the food, out goes the effluent. In come the fossil fuels, out go the carbon emissions. In come the petrochemicals, out go the plastic. On average, Americans consume more than 3 times the amount of food they need to survive and about 250 times as much water. In return, they produce 4.4 pounds of trash each day, recycling or composting only about a third of it. Thanks to things such as cars, planes, big homes, and power-hungry clothes dryers, the annual carbon dioxide emissions of an average American are 5 times as high as the global average. Even the floor, below which even monks living in American monasteries typically do not go, is twice the global average. It isn't just that Americans consume and waste so much. It's that hundreds of millions of other people consume and waste as much, and in some cases more, and billions of other people are moving in that same direction. If everyone in the world consumed as Americans do for 1 year, the nonprofit Global Footprint Network estimates it would take the Earth 4 years to regenerate what has been used and absorb what has been wasted. This is textbook unsustainability. We use and use and use and return little of value to our natural world. The increasing number of scientists making 100-year warnings has formed around a terrifying environmental reality. Even with very stringent and unrealistically ambitious abatement strategies, we likely will not be able to prevent global temperature changes that will be greater than 2 degrees Celsius, a tipping point that many scientists believe will be catastrophic for humanity. Indeed, as Fenner said, it might truly be too late. We are not yet at that 2-degree tipping point, and nonetheless, the consequences are already quite staggering. Human-caused climate change is destroying food webs around the globe, and by some estimates, 1 in 6 species is now at risk of extinction. Warming temperatures have cooked the life out of the corals of our oceans, including the Great Barrier Reef, which is roughly the size of California and the most diverse ecosystem on our planet. More than 90% of that Australian natural wonder has suffered from bleaching, meaning it is being starved of the algae it needs to survive. In 2018, the Australian government released a report acknowledging what scientists had been saying for many years, that the reef is headed towards collapse. And in the same year, Australian researchers said that global warming had claimed its first mammalian victim, a long-tailed marsupial mouse called the Bramble K. melames, which was sent into extinction when its island ecosystem was destroyed by surging seawater. There can also be no debate at this point that the melting of the Antarctic and Greenland ice caps is driving a rise in sea levels, which the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association and others have warned will worsen coastal flooding in the coming years, threatening cities such as New York, Miami, Philadelphia, Houston, Fort Lauderdale, Galveston, Boston, Rio de Janeiro, Amsterdam, Mumbai, Osaka, Guangzhou, and Shanghai. 1 billion people or more live in areas likely to be affected by rising sea levels. Meanwhile, we're facing more and more severe hurricanes, floods, and droughts. The World Health Organization estimates that 150,000 people are already dying each year as a direct result of climate change, and that number is likely to at least double in coming years. All of these dire warnings are predicated upon a world in which humans live for an average of about 75 or 80 years. Thus, even the most pessimistic of assertions about the future of our environment are actually underestimating the extent of the problem. There is simply no model in which more years of life does not equate to more people, and in which that does not lead to more crowding, more environmental degradation, more consumption, and more waste. As we live longer, these environmental crises will be exacerbated, and that could be only part of our woes. the 100-year politician. If there has been a consistent driving force that has made our world a kinder, more tolerant, more inclusive, and more just place, it is that humans don't last long. Social, legal, and scientific revolutions, after all, are waged, as the economist Paul Samuelson often noted, one funeral at a time. The quantum physicist Max Planck also knew this to be true. A new scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents and making them see the light, Planck wrote shortly before his death in 1947, but rather because its opponents eventually die and a new generation grows up that is familiar with it. Having witnessed a few different sorts of revolutions during my life, from the fall of the Berlin Wall in Europe to the rise of LGBTQ rights in the United States to the strengthening of national gun laws in Australia and New Zealand, I can vouch for these insights. People can change their minds about things. Compassion and common sense can move nations. And yes, the market of ideas has certainly had an impact on the way we vote when it comes to issues such as civil rights, animal rights, the ways we treat the sick and people with special needs, and death with dignity. But it is the mortal attrition of those who steadfastly hold on to old views that most permits new values to flourish in a democratic world. Death by death, the world sheds ideas that need to be shed. Ipso facto, birth by birth, the world is offered an opportunity to do things better. Alas, we don't always get it right, and it's often a slow and uneven sort of progress. With a generation time of 20 minutes, bacteria evolve rapidly to survive a new challenge. With a generation time of 20 years, human culture and ideas can take decades to evolve. Sometimes they devolve. In recent years, nationalism has moved from being the purview of angry fringe groups to being the force behind powerful political movements around the world. There is no one single factor that can explain all these movements, but the economist Haroon Onder is among those who have made a demographic observation. Nationalist arguments tend to resonate with older people. Therefore, it is likely that the anti-globalist wave will be with us for some time to come. Virtually every country in the world, the United Nations reported in 2015, is experiencing growth in the number and proportion of older persons in their population. Europe and North America already have the largest per capita share of older persons. By 2030, according to the report, those over the age of 60 will account for more than a quarter of the population on both of these continents, and that proportion will continue to grow for decades to come. Once again, these are estimates based on ridiculously low projections for lengthened lifespans. Older constituencies support older politicians. As it is now, politicians seem steadfastly opposed to stepping down in their 70s and 80s. More than half of the US senators running for re-election in 2018 was 65 or older. Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi was 78 that year. Dianne Feinstein and Chuck Grassley, two powerful senators, were 85. On average, members of the US Congress are 20 years older than their constituents. At the time of his death in 2003, Strom Thurmond was 100 years old and had served 48 years as a US senator. That Thurmond was a centenarian in Congress is no vice. We want our leaders to have experience and wisdom, as long as they aren't stuck in the past. The travesty was that Thurmond somehow managed to keep his seat in spite of a long record of supporting segregation and opposing civil rights, including basic voting rights. At the age of 99, he voted to use military force in Iraq, opposed legislation to make pharmaceuticals more affordable, and helped kill a bill that would have added sexual orientation, gender, and disability to a list of categories covered by hate crimes legislation. After his death, the family values politician was revealed to have had a daughter with his family's teenage African-American housekeeper when he was 22, which was almost certainly an act of statutory rape under South Carolina law. Though he knew about the child, he never publicly acknowledged her. Thurmond lived in retirement only 6 months. Those who were too young to vote then will have to live with the consequences of his votes for the rest of their lives. We tend to tolerate a bit of bigotry among older people as a condition of the age in which they grew up, but perhaps also because we know we won't have to live with it for long. Consider, though, a world in which people in their 60s will be voting